Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. One thing we know when we ask people about their work lives, and we ask them things like, well, how do you feel about how your work goes, how that presses on your time, how that gets in the way of spending time with your family? People do indeed say, yes, that is a problem. They say that I don't think that I have enough time to spend with my wife and my kids and for myself. And a lot of that has to do with the increasing demands of work. Nowadays, just about everybody works outside the household. Certainly, at least there are many, many families where there are two wage earners. Men and women, moms and dads are working, and they're working a lot. On average, both men and women are working more than 40 hours a week. And they say they could use a little bit more flexibility in their work arrangements to make it possible for them to spend time with their families and not only be able to take care of their children, but in some cases be able to take care of their aging parents. There are some industries and some employers who are starting to respond to this, and also people who work in the public policy arena who are thinking more and more about it. And we have two guests with us this morning who are among those, Ellen Galinsky and Karen Kornblum will be talking with us today. Ellen Galinsky is president and co-founder of Families and Work Institute. It's a nonprofit organization. It's based in Manhattan. It does research on the changing family and the changing workforce. She has authored over 25 books and reports, including The Six Stages of Parenthood, The Preschool Years, and a groundbreaking book, Ask the Children, the breakthrough study that reveals how to succeed at work and parenting. That was selected by the Wall Street Journal as one of the best work-life books in 1999. At the Institute, she co-directs the National Study of the Changing Workforce. It's a nationally representative study of the workforce that's updated every 5 years, which was originally conducted by the Department of Labor. And before all of this, she was a college professor. She was on the faculty of Bank Street College of Education for 25 years, where she helped to establish the field of work and family life. Karen Kornblum is director of the Work and Family Program at the New America Foundation. That's a program that's interested in trying to change public policies to give working families more flexibility. She has published many different places, has done a lot of talking in the media like this. Before being involved with the New America Foundation, she worked for the Secretary of the Treasury, Robert Rubin. She was Deputy Chief of Staff. Before that, she had a position at the FCC, where she was Director of Legislative and Intergovernmental Affairs. And before that, she was Legislative Assistant to Senator John Kerry. She began her career as an economist at Alan Greenspan's economic forecasting firm, Townsend Greenspan and Company. Both of them have written a lot on this issue and have done a lot of speaking on this issue, and we're pleased to have them both with us on the program this morning, both on the telephone. As we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and also get in as many different people as possible. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And, of course, at any point here, people are welcome to join the conversation. Well, Ellen Galinsky, good morning.
Good morning.
And Karen Kornblum.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you both very much for being with us. And I think maybe the place to start out, and maybe I'll start with Ellen Galinsky, and Ms. Kornblum, I'm sure that you can add on to this, but because I know that, Ms. Galinsky, you have been involved in a number of these reports and studies, kind of looking at how the workplace has changed, what sort of demands that places on workers, how many hours are worked, and how they feel about all that. And maybe that would be a good place to start, particularly to talk a little bit about how the demands of the workplace have changed and maybe how the workplace has changed in a relatively short period of time. Say, you know, since the end of World War II, since the early or mid-1950s, it really things have changed a lot.
Well, actually, if you start with World War II, there were many, many women in the workforce. It was considered patriotic during that time, and the workplaces were quite responsive. So the real shift was, at least in our recent memory, was after World War II, when women went back home, and then starting in the 70s when increasingly mothers went back into the workforce. At the same time, the economy has changed, and the workplace has changed. And so what you have is some things happening that are very positive and some things happening that are difficult for working people. For example, hours have increased dramatically. Men now work 48.2 hours on average, and women work 41.4 hours per week on average. And that includes the one out of every four women who are working part-time. 61% of the workforce thinks that they would prefer to work fewer hours than they do, and it's largely unscheduled hours. It's the extra hours that people work that is causing the problem, because on average people are scheduled for about 40 hours a week. What you see is a time famine. 67% of employed parents say that they don't have enough time with their kids, and that stayed relatively stable for the last 10 years. Where there's been a shift has been time for your husband or your wife. It's gone from 50% in 1992 to 63%. So people are not giving up time as much with their children, and data show that in fact people are keeping their children as a priority, but they're cutting back on sleep, they're cutting back on time for their husband or their wives, they're cutting back on cleaning their houses, and they're cutting back on time for themselves, and in fact 55% say that they don't have enough time for themselves. The workplace has changed. It's gotten more flexible. More people have access to flex time, for example, up from 29% in up to 10 years ago to 43% now. But at the same time, hours have gotten longer and work has become more demanding and hectic. So supervisors are more supportive when people have personal or family issues. We see that in our surveys of the U.S. workforce. But technology has blurred the lines between when you're working and when you're not, and a lot of people are being called by their workplaces during non-work hours or non-work days. So that's kind of a quick picture of what's happening in terms of time.
And when you talk about people working, having a certain number of hours that they're scheduled and expected to work, and yet the demands of work seem to extend past that, is this a matter of a shrinking workforce, that is, fewer people are expected to do the same or more work, or is that just that? And to what extent do you think people feel that they can't complain, they can't say anything about it, because they have a job and they need to keep the job they have?
Well, it's complicated, because it's never a simple either or kind of an answer. Yes, the downsizing has led to the same amount or more work, particularly as work has become more 24/7. And so there are fewer people doing the same or more work, as you said. You're exactly right. We also see how long you work in a funny way as a red badge of courage. You know, not that we particularly want it, but people boast, well, I work this many hours, well, I work this many hours, well, I'm this exhausted, I'm that exhausted. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. When we ask people why they work longer hours than they want to, 53% said that they had to work longer hours to achieve their own standards, and 47%, you could answer as many answers as were true for you, 47% said that they had to do it to keep up with the long hours, with all the work that they had, and 43% said that they wouldn't be successful because in our economy, presence still equals productivity. For some people, it's the earning, that they couldn't earn as much money, but that's a smaller percentage, 37%. 34%, it's still one out of every three, feel that they would lose their job if they worked fewer hours. And 16% said that they felt pressured by their supervisor or manager to work longer hours. So it's a mixed bag. It's what we do to ourselves. It's what the workplace has done to us.
Let me turn to our other guest, Karen Kornblau, because I said at the beginning that one of the things that the program that you're involved in at New America Foundation is interested in is public policy.
And, that's right.
And perhaps changing public policy to try to give greater support to families who are dealing with the very sorts of circumstances that Ellen Galinsky was just talking about. So I guess just as a general question here at the beginning, how well is government responding to the needs of working families?
Well, there's a real structural lag, if you will. We had a family that was really a breadwinner, homemaker model, and a lot of policies were designed around that. In 1960, 70% of families had a parent home full-time, usually the mother home full-time. And today, it's the reverse. In over 70% of all families, there's no one home full-time. It's either two working parents or a single parent who's working. Dramatic change. We also had a system where the employer was this paternalistic employer, and an employee would work for that employer 40 hours a week, maybe 40 years in a row, and that employer was expected to provide health insurance, pension, on through retirement. That system has changed, too. So we've gone from the breadwinner homemaker to the juggler family. We've gone from the company man, if you will, to a global free agent, an employee who's shifting jobs every 5 years, competing against workers in other countries. Dramatic changes in both the family and the economy, but the policy framework was really designed for that old family and that old economy, and it hasn't changed. So what do I mean exactly? If you take something like health insurance, we rely on employers to give health insurance, and there's a taxpayer subsidy for that. Well, that creates a big fixed cost for an employer for every employee that gets health insurance, and they're less likely to let that employee work part-time and still get health insurance. And there are a number of examples that work like that, where the system was set up for the breadwinner, the company man, doesn't work so well for the new family.
Well, pardon me for interrupting. Go ahead.
No. And so one of the things that we're looking at is how can you update that antiquated policy framework in a way that would actually allow families to work more flexibly, to do the caregiving they need to do and the jobs they need to put food on the table, but also have economic security. So you shouldn't have to, in order to get flexibility, give up your economic security.
The interesting thing, David, about flexibility is there is assumption that it's a zero-sum game. That is, if people have flexibility, they're not going to be productive. And what the research shows, we have a new report about effective workplaces, and what it shows is that, in fact, flexibility can, it doesn't always, but it can, and at best it does, work both for the employer and it works for the employee. It helps the employee manage life in this juggler world that Karen is describing, and it helps the employer have employees who are truly committed, engaged, willing to go that extra mile for their employer, more likely to want to stay, and better mental health and so forth. So that there's a real benefit, even though we have to bypass some of our notions of how work gets done and what it means to be a committed, loyal worker. That is, face time equals commitment and loyalty.
Well, it seems to me that's a very important point. At least I'm sure it would be in the minds of employers, because when you're talking about flexibility, what you're talking about things like workers being able to set their own hours and making maybe working unconventional schedules. That is, maybe they work 3 days a week for 10 hours a day, or they do some of their working from home, or you may be even talking about something like job sharing, where you have two people who were each work part-time, and together they make up one full-time worker. And all of those things, there are examples of all of those things out there in the workplace, but what you're having to struggle against, I'm sure, is the idea that employers have is that they want to be able to walk through their office and see people's butts in the chairs at their desks from 8 to 5. And that's, you know, that's because at least in their mind, they will have some idea, well, I see my workers, they're at their desks, they're typing, they're on the telephone, they're doing work. And if I can't see them, how do I know what they're doing?
Exactly. I think that's the issue. Our definition of flexibility is that it has to work for the employer and it has to work for the employee. So it calls for a new kind of problem solving, not just an entitlement, not just the notion that employees are going to take control and do whatever they want, but looking at these issues from what do we need to do to get the job done as best we can, as productively as we can, to make our organization successful, and what can we do to help the employee have the life that he or she wants and needs outside of work. And if you take that dual perspective, actually you can come up with solutions that are amazing. We've been doing traveling around the country, speaking to Chamber of Commerce audiences in 8 to 9 different communities. And what we've found is employers are doing this because they want to keep their best employees. They want them to be the most effective, and they're coming up with some amazing solutions that have this dual purpose. That is, they work for both. And it's just this grassroots phenomenon that's happening that's been under the radar screen when, again, the prevailing assumption is that it can't work, it won't work.
We have a couple of callers here, and I want to bring them into the conversation, and I probably should reintroduce our guests for anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes even. Ellen Galinsky is president and co-founder of the Families and Work Institute. It's a nonprofit organization. It's based in Manhattan that does research on the changing family and workforce. Karen Kornbluh is with the New America Foundation. She is director of the Work and Family Program there at New America, and they're very much interested in changing public policy to give more support to families today where everybody's working and everybody's working hard. Questions here are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. First caller up here is listening in Indiana this morning on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Unfortunately, all the questions I'd like to ask, this is the one I want to, is more, an attitude, and may not be at all a bit germane, but anecdotally, I remember when I first entered the workforce for a man in the summer, you know, as a student, he asked me to work over, and I refused. And since he was sort of a nice guy, he didn't fire me. But since that time, I've been in places where if you were a member of the union, you were required to work overtime, or the union wouldn't sit and it wouldn't get behind you. And my attitude always was, well, when I see the manager in here on Saturday and Sunday, that's when I'll work. I don't know if this fits into anything you're trying to do or would. And I have all the flexibility in the world. I'm retired. But I spend a fair amount of my time thinking about the social relationships. And I guess that's irked me over the last 50 years more than anything, is that I just felt like I was getting, you know, screwed, basically. And because the boy would come in, do his paperwork, and leave, and the rest of us were left more or less with, you know, doing things. And I never have accepted that and basically worked because I needed the money rather than anything else in terms of, like, loyalty or anything like that. I mean, I was switching jobs way back when. I didn't wait 5 years. You know, whenever I got an opportunity, I moved. And most of it was on the basis that if somebody asked me to work overtime, they would have to understand that I wasn't going to do it or there was no reason to hire me. Worked out pretty well for me, basically. But, of course, I was educated and I worked in laboratories, so that may have added a pronounced, you know, an aspect to it that's not normal for the regular person who's doing, you know, more like regular industrial work or in retail or something like that. If that's germane, please give an answer. If not, then I accept it and continue to listen.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah, David, it's very interesting that in the U.S. we have no limit on overtime. So if you want to refuse overtime, you can be fired for that. Similarly, we have no minimum sick leave. There are many people in this country, as Ellen has documented, who can't take sick leave or can't be paid for sick leave or vacation time. They have absolutely no right to it. If a child is sick, they may risk losing their job to stay home with a child.
Employees, in fact.
And so that's it's a system that was designed, probably never worked that well when you had the old breadwinner homemaker, but at least then you had somebody home full-time who could be with that child when the worker had to work overtime or when the child was sick. But today it absolutely doesn't work, and we are lagging far behind other countries in that respect. I mean, we're one of two industrialized countries that doesn't offer paid maternity leave. recent study out of Harvard just showed how far behind we are in terms of sick leave as well. So these are real public policy issues. And I think what the caller also spoke to is the fact that it can be very different if you're the kind of employee who has some leverage. You can ask these things of your employer and not necessarily have to pay the price of your job. Other workers who don't have leverage perhaps need some basic floors on what kinds of protections they have and what kind of minimum leave they can have.
Do you, Ms. Galinsky, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think Karen said it very well, that he was able to work the way he wanted to and feels really good about it, which is terribly important, because he had the skills and the knowledge that were in demand. And so there was a give and take. People needed him. And so that makes it easier to negotiate.
Let's talk again with another caller. This is Atlanta, not Georgia, but Illinois, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Interesting conversation as usual. What I would like to say, I think part of these problems is that we had at least a method or a way of solving these problems last century with unions. And with unions, at least that there was overtime, whether it was mandatory or not, there was an extreme penalty that a company had to pay for that overtime through unions. And whenever there was a problem as far as cash flow to that company, the first thing that they would do is cut out the overtime. I mean, no more overtime is what would go out to the managers. And so there was really a penalty for having overtime. So the question is, what do you think the correlation is to the plight we have today, to the downfall of unions?
Well, you do have only right now about 12% of employees in the United States represented by a union. And interestingly enough, unions have fought very hard and obtained a lot of protections for employees. Flexibility, we did a study that looked at whether employees were represented or not, and flexibility, they had many cash benefits, but they had less flexibility. So it seems to me that those people who do have a union, having them work toward more flexibility would be a very important step.
Well, at least with a union, there is kind of a voice there that, unions might need to change direction and do something different, but you had the vehicle for accomplishing a lot of the things that you're trying to do, and you had the vehicle maybe to put more pressure on a company to do it, because, you know, more people demanding something is better than one person demanding it. So from my point of view, I would think that maybe we had solved this problem earlier, and for some reason now we're going to have to solve the problem all over again, and I appreciate your conversation, and thanks.
All right, thanks for the call. We, in a number of the stories that I have read about this issue, particularly the issue of workers that are looking for more flexibility in their jobs, you see many instances where people have said, look, for this reason in my life, I'm looking for this kind of flexibility, and they've gone to their employer and said, can you give it to me? And the employer says no, and then the person has no choice but to quit. And here and there are stories, and I don't know how many people could do this, but stories who have people who have actually quit their jobs but then turned around and started their own businesses or worked out of their home. And interestingly enough, at least it seems to me that a lot of these people seem to be women, are the ones that are saying to their employer, if you can't give me the flexibility I need, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to quit. I wonder how much of that happens and how much that has to happen before employers notice and get the message and say, you know, I'm losing good people here and maybe I should be doing something about it rather than just seeing them walk out the door.
Well, I think that is a very important point. In our travels around the country talking to chambers of commerce, we have heard so many stories of women but also of men who just the workplace didn't work for them, and that's why our project, which interestingly enough, is funded by a corporation, IBM. It's called When Work Works. It's also funded by the Sloan Foundation. And we've heard these stories of both women and men who, again, They wouldn't have talked about work and family life particularly. They wouldn't. They just thought of creating a workplace that would work better for them, making work better and making their home life better. And so there are these amazing creative examples. I will say that when employees take the notion of, you know, I'm going to tell you what I need, but not think of what the employer needs, then they do tend to get a no for an answer. It's the employee who is in the situation of needing something different in his or her life does better by going and saying, okay, here's what the company needs, or here's what my boss needs, or here's what my job needs, and here's what I need, and let's look for the place in the middle where we both can succeed.
I just wanted to make another point about the example that you give, David, which I think is absolutely right, that a lot of people, because they're faced with these sort of choiceless choices between this full-time, inflexible job or quitting, will try to create their own third option, which is, I'm going to start my own business. I'm going to become a consultant. And that would be great. That would be the market working, and sooner or later, it would all work out in the wash. The only problem is, again, our antiquated public policy system, so that if you are part of that one quarter of the workforce that is non-standard, it's called, either self-employed or you're a temp or you're part-time, you're faced with completely different benefits, health insurance and pension. You're in different tax situation. You have different protections at the workplace if you do have an employer. We still have that old employer-based system, for instance, of benefits. For instance, if you're a full-time worker and you get your health insurance through your employer, he gives you the contribution to your health insurance before tax. If you have to buy your own health insurance because you're self-employed, or you're an employee who doesn't get health insurance through your employer, you have to buy that health insurance on the open market. You have no employer contribution, and your tax situation is completely different. You're not getting the same tax subsidy, so it's not all equivalent. If you have to cobble together your flexibility yourself by leaving your good job, you can pay a very, very high penalty in terms of your economic security.
Mm. Well, I have some other callers here. Just real quick, one thing I do want to mention for people who are listening, and that is assuming that also that they have access to the Internet. I know everyone doesn't, but for those people who do, if you're interested in reading about the organizations that we're talking about here today, that is the New America Foundation and the Families and Work Institute, they have websites, and there is a lot of information there. For example, if you go to the Families and Work Institute website, you can read that report that Ellen Galinsky was talking about a little bit ago, When Work Works. And then also on the website of the New America Foundation, there's information about the work and family program and a lot of the other issues that, you know, political, social issues that the folks at New America are interested in. So that is one way to get more information on this subject.
Could I just make one quick comment?
Yes.
Which is that I think that Karen was talking about pensions, and I do think that this is probably the place where we're going to see a change. That is, the United States is going to increasingly need older workers because there will be expected talent shortages unless we continue to either offshore or, you know, bring in talent in another way, particularly among skilled occupations. Older workers also have seen their pensions erode, and so they're going to want to work, but they're going to want to work in a different way, as our first caller talked about. I think that among people 60 or older who are still working, 57% of them either have or want part-time work. I think we're going to need some changes in public policy and in employment practice that make this possible, because it's going to be needed. The market system possibly will work more here than maybe in other places, and it will be a lever for some change.
All right. Well, let's talk with some other people who are listening. And next, we go to Chicago, line number two. Hello.
Hello. In the litany of things that you mentioned that get short shrift as families try to mix family life with work, One thing you didn't mention, and something I've noticed, is that civil and community life is gets cut. I've noticed in my community that, first of all, at my church, we don't have volunteers. We rely on seniors, and quite often we no longer have seniors because they very often are engaged in babysitting for their working children. I also noticed we have many wonderful free programs at our local library, but we always have very low attendance in the evening, and I assume it's because maybe people are trying to do their household chores because they were working all day. So even though the programs are free and helpful, we're lucky if six or eight people attend. Civil life, as far as homeowners meetings, unless there's a major crisis, there's very low attendance. And it's really almost as if families have had to pull inwards, and it's a shame because they need the community and they need to get to know people to help them as they try to carry a lot of burdens, and they're not able to. They're simply not participating.
That's so well said. And I think that's a problem that's really not talked about enough. We did a poll with a Democratic and a Republican pollster, Anna Greenberg and Bill McInturf, and they looked at how so many voters really feel the same way as your caller. They came up with data that 77% of voters think that it's difficult for families to earn enough and still have time to be with their families, and 84% feel that children are being shortchanged. They see that there's this values issue, that there's something that the society and the community are lacking because people are working so hard. I don't think people are blaming the parents as much as saying, you know, the economy's gotten tougher and people are having to work longer and longer hours, but the result is that something's missing, both in terms of the way children are being raised and also in terms of what's going on with society.
Well, I can give you one example. We had a reading program for children during the summer, and it was held in the daytime hours, and there was only one adult volunteer who worked as an education reporter for a paper, and so she was able to take time off from her work to help. But there were no adult volunteers that summer. What they ended up using were mainly older children to read to the younger children.
And, you know, some companies, and this certainly doesn't solve the societal problem, which I agree is critically important, some companies are beginning to step into the breach and give employees paid time off to volunteer. I just was on a conference call yesterday learning about what PNC is doing in the areas in which it has banks, where they've given 40 paid hours for employees to volunteer around children's issues. Some enlightened companies will see that in their self-interest. Others, of course, won't, and that's why I think Karen and I are working so hard to address this as a larger societal issue.
Well, if I can just make one last comment, I think this really turns up when people, during elections, I think people feel that they don't know enough about an election and it's easier not to vote because they haven't had the time to attend any meetings that might have been held by groups up until the point of the election.
Building on that, I also think that there is these issues haven't really been articulated well as public policy issues and political issues. So it may be that the very people that are suffering from this could look to the political arena to find solutions. But the politicians aren't necessarily talking about it. We as a country haven't really seen these as public problems. We've seen them as private problems. And parents with children make up a third of voters, which is actually a larger group than seniors. But the seniors have done a much better job, as we all know, of articulating what their public policy interests are. Parents, maybe because they're so busy, really haven't. And we just think that it's up to each and every family to solve this problem of, gee, I'm working so hard and I have to take care of my kids and my job isn't accommodating all the things that I need to do and the child care is so expensive, so I'm finding substandard child care and there's no after school. And part of, I think, what Alan and I and others are each doing in our own way is trying to think through how this is a public problem as well as a private problem. And then maybe some of these parents will feel more of a reason to get involved in the political process.
I think if they heard about it in the public arena, they certainly could see a greater role for getting involved.
That's Thank you.
All right, thanks. Well, this is an election year. We're going to have a presidential election here in the state of Illinois. We're going to elect a new senator. And, of course, all down the line, people are going to be running for Congress. They're going to be running for state legislatures. I just wonder, maybe let's say at the national level in the presidential race, Karen, do you think that family issues are going to have some prominence?
Well, I think they're a natural. They don't always rise to the top, but, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, a year before he ran for governor, the way he positioned himself was on an after-school initiative in California. He saw that was a great issue to cut across party lines, that parents were working, that people were worried about what teenagers were doing after school, that taxpayers didn't like the fact that they were paying for prison and welfare when, if they'd just gotten it right in the first place, these kids would stay out of trouble. So he put together an initiative with an amazing coalition, and it really positioned him as a guy who understood what was really going on. And before that, in 1992, Bill Clinton had done the same thing with the Family and Medical Leave Act, that when he, in the election of 92, talked about how people felt they had to choose between the job they needed and the family they loved. Families understood that he understood what they were going through, and it was one of his biggest applause lines. It was the first bill he signed, and he talked about it in every State of the Union address because he realized what a political winner it is. And so I think politicians ignore this issue sometimes at their peril. I think it's incredibly important, and as Ellen and I were both saying, I think it is politically potent.
Karen and I launched this study that we're doing and the efforts of the New America Foundation at a hearing in the Senate with a subcommittee on children and families. And at that hearing, Senator Lamar Alexander said that the government was as out of sync with families as companies are, and that we need to make this a much more compelling issue for us to realize that it's not a personal issue, for us to realize that it is. Lots of people are feeling this, therefore there need to be more collective solutions for companies to realize that there are things that they could do to have a more energized, motivated, committed, and engaged workforce, and for society to do, for politicians, their bottom line is being voted, for them to realize that this is something that could unleash some of the apathy among voters.
I'm so glad you brought up Lamar Alexander. He has said that his agenda in this area is parents raising children. And I think, you know, too often the family values debate becomes about what's a family, you know, what's a good family, what's a bad family, as opposed to saying, let's think about what kind of supports all parents who are raising kids need. There's been an interesting sub-debate, at least on the Democratic side in the presidential, about the middle class squeeze. And I think that's come close to talking about these issues. They've talked about how families are constrained in terms of the cost of college and health insurance and the need for after-school and child care. So there has been the beginnings of a conversation about that in this presidential election. I hope it will continue.
Yeah. We have some other callers here. Well, let's go on and talk next with someone in the nearby community of Belgium. That's line one. Hello.
Hello. If I could go back to where the gentleman was talking earlier, in the last century, which sounds so old ago, I worked for various corporations, and they wanted plenty of overtime, and of course they got it. And then when times went south, they got rid of people, me being one of them. And so I decided to get my own job. And well, when I got my own job, my own business, I worked very hard, and that presented a problem because that kept me away from my family rather quickly. And I took a long time to learn that you can force your own self into these positions of work, work, work. You know, you don't have to have somebody else over top you saying, we want more and more hours.
Exactly right. It is, as I said in the beginning, like a red badge of courage. And it, you know, I think that, were you able to change things in your own business? Were you able to create the life that you wanted for yourself and also help your company?
Oh, yes, but I made the early decision in that I never wanted an employee, so I would have to do that to them.
Mm-hmm. So you work alone?
I work alone. And I finally, after a while, I work for large corporations, and mm-hmm. they're very accommodating. But I say, you know, I'm going to do it my way. mm-hmm. and much more accommodating than they were when I worked for them.
I think that that is a change. That is, your story is so typical. And again, it's I think that the point you make is critically important, which is that this is not just women. That this is men, this is women, this is younger workers, this is older workers, you know, people in the middle. It's all of us, I think, are saying that we're not living the life that we want to live. And 9/11, in some, you know, strange way, made us each think about what's important in our own lives. I think was in a sense a way of saying, what are our priorities? What how do we want to be? How do we want to live? How do we want to be remembered? And so that is also changed the tenor too.
Well, you have to make the physical choice of saying, I want to slow down a little bit.
Right.
I do not want to keep up with Mr.
Right.
and Mrs. Jones.
That's one thing that we as a country haven't done a good job of thinking about, which is, what's the end goal? Do we want a high quality of life? And I think we didn't have to think about it in the past, because in the immediate post-war period, wages were going up, and so our recent history had been that workers could work fewer and fewer hours. The Fair Labor Standards Act created this 40-hour work week, which was a break for a lot of people. And they could still, even working 40 hours a week, they could see their income go up and up and up. And I think now we have to think about, what is the point of working, and are we really creating a high quality of life for us and our kids, and how do we cobble that together as a nation?
Do we want the next generation who are going to take care of us to be like? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's an important point. We made it before, but I think it's worth making again, as Ellen Galinsky said, this issue that's often seen as a women's issue, or often seen as an issue that has to do with people who have children, and it's not just women who are interested in having this flexibility, and it's not just people who have kids.
Right.
And of course, another thing that we know is that more and more, as the population ages, we're going to have people who are taking care of aging parents. So that's I know a lot of people say on the horizon, and maybe it's not even all that far off, that's going to be the next huge family issue that we as a society and employers are going to have to deal with, that is people taking care of their parents.
Right, exactly. 35%, so more than a third, already do. Equally likely to be women and men.
Hmm.
So it is something that is going to continue to happen as the workforce ages. A lot of people are taking care of their parents and their children, so they're in that sandwich generation. And there's much more generational diversity. One of the things that I think is just rings true for everyone is that this is not your father's workplace.
Yeah.
You know, this is the economy has changed, that people have changed, that work has changed. And therefore, we all have to change with it, and that's the point that our research pointed out, I think.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have a couple of people we'll get right to, but again, I think I should introduce again our guests. That last person you heard, that's Ellen Galinsky. She's president, co-founder of the Families and Work Institute. It's a nonprofit. It's based in Manhattan. They do research on the changing family and workforce. Also joining us this morning, Karen Kornbluh from the New America Foundation, and she's director of the Work and Family Program there, and what they're interested in is the reform of public policies in order to give working families better support. Both of them, as I said, both organizations have websites. If you have internet access, you can go there and you can read some of the research and the writing that they have both done on this very issue. We have some other folks here to talk with. Let's go next to Champagne, line number 3. Hello.
Hi. I'm a stay-at-home mother. I worked in information technology for about 10 years before becoming a stay-at-home mother, and simply for the reason that, you know, the job is just so inflexible that it's either you work 100%, you know, 60 hours a week or what have you, or you don't work at all. It's not, you can work 30 hours or, you know, anything reasonable. And so instead of working for pay, I am right now an unpaid activist for an organization called Mothers and More. And I do their power online programs. And we have a power plan that has one of the things that meshes right in with what you're talking about. Mothers have the right to fulfill their caregiving responsibilities without incurring social and economic penalties. And there's some other things that dovetail with what you're talking about. The Take Back Your Time Day, which happened last October, and there was an excellent little book that Take Back Your Time Day people put out that talked about all this time poverty and so forth. And there's a guy named Fritjof Bergman who talks about one-third, 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 where you have one-third personal time, one-third community time, one-third, you know, sort of market work time. So I just thought I'd throw those things out and see what you had to say about them.
Well, I know about Take Back Your Time, that whole movement and Mothers and More, and I think that you're, you know, there's this notion that there is this, you know, one camp that is employed mothers and one camp that is at-home mothers, and it's Mothers and More has done so much important work to dispel that notion that we're all caring about together whether or not people are employed, because also people move in and out of the workforce.
Right.
And that we're really need to be all in the same camp to make things happen that work better for kids and families.
Exactly.
We need to work together, and I think that is a very important movement that is happening that will, I think, fulfill the kinds of dreams that Karen and I have of making this a more visible and public issue. So thank you for all that you're doing.
All right. Well, again, thank you for the call. Let's go on. We have someone listening in Charleston, and we'll go there. Line 4. Hello.
Hi there. Pardon me if I am bringing up a topic. It's been up already. I've been in and out of the conversation. But I'm wondering, in your research, if you survey the families about labor unions, because the membership in unions has declined steadily since the 50s. And it seems to be a topic that the unions ought to be right on top of to try to fight that declining membership. Is there something about the unions families are trying to stay away from? Is there something at the unions? Do you survey them to find out, you know, why aren't you guys doing anything about this?
Let me answer, and then Karen can jump in. Our surveys are nationally representative, so included in our samples of U.S. employees are people who are union members. We also are just about to go out with a survey of employers that will include employers that are unionized and employers that are not unionized. When we did this last survey a couple of years ago, we found that in many respects, unionized employers had, you know, very good kinds of support and leverage. But around flexibility, they had less. So I agree with you that this is a very important issue for unions to be on top of, because it's an issue on the minds of their members. Karen?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And just to add a little bit about what's, you know, the changing environment where you have less union involvement, less worker leverage perhaps in the global economy, some new data that we're working with the Economic Policy Institute on shows that wages have really stagnated over the last few decades, and that has meant that if you didn't have two people working, in many families, income would have gone down, whereas in middle-income families, it would have gone up much, much less than it did. So I think one thing that may have happened at the same time as you had union membership declining, and you know, I don't think you can draw a simple connection between it, but it was happening at the same time, is that wages were stagnating, and that was one of the things making it absolutely necessary to have two people working. And then if you add into that the inflexibility of the workplace, it really makes the problem very difficult.
Is there anything in your surveys that talks about perceptions or attitudes towards labor unions among the workers, about perhaps, you know, why they're not turning that way, or why they're not looking for a collective arrangement that way?
I haven't. Karen, have you?
No, our work hasn't looked at that. I know there are a number of people who have, you know, looked at that question, and part of it is, of course, that the industries that unions that were very strong in that's less where the employment is, and employment has shifted to other industries where unions didn't have as much of a stronghold.
Well, I'm going to have to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me, but we're here at the end of the time. We're going to have to finish. But again, I do want to mention that if you're interested in reading up on this issue and some of the thoughts of our two guests, they each of their organizations have websites, and there's lots of information on there. Karen Kohnblue from the New America Foundation, she's director of the Work and Family Program, and Ellen Galinsky is president, co-founder of Families and Work Institute. And Ms. Galinsky, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you for having both of us. It was a real pleasure to be on, and I love the discussion with you and with your callers.
Great. And Karen Kohnblue, thank you, too, very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.